Hello, friends. Welcome back to the Death with Dignity podcast, episode 9. Kim Callanan is the CEO of an advocacy organization called Compassion and Choices, or CNC. CNC advocates for legislation regarding medical aid in dying and are recognized as the largest nonprofit advocacy group in the country related to medical aid in dying. In this episode, Kim explains to us why she became involved in the field, the purpose and mission of Compassion and Choices, and even how you as a listener can help advocate for the movement in both big and small ways. We encourage you to check out their website at www.compassionandchoices.org, and we thank Kim for sharing her story with us. Enjoy the episode.
Well, cool. We'll kind of get things started if that's okay, Kim. And I always like to kind of start with our guests by asking them to tell us about yourself, just who you are, where you're from, if you have any family, anything personal you'd like to share or educational experience. Fill us in. Just give us a little snippet of who you are.
Thanks, Andrew. My name is Kim Callanan, and I live in the Maryland area just outside of Washington, D.C. I have been married for 25 years in May, and I have two children, both adults now, a 19-year-old and a 21-year-old, and both of them are in college at the moment. And I lead Compassion and Choices, which is the largest national organization that is devoted to improving care and expanding options at the end of life.
Excellent. And tell us about how, because obviously that's what this whole podcast is kind of about, the End of Life Option Act. Tell us about how you got involved with Compassionate Choices.
Sure. So my desire to work at Compassionate Choices really stemmed from my own personal experience with end of life issues. I had a grandmother who had an advanced directive that wasn't honored, and she ended up on a breathing tube at the end, with very invasive procedures. And my very last recollection was her pulling the tubes out, getting very angry, and this feeling like we had violated her at the end instead of her getting the graceful exit that she was seeking. And then when you fast forward about 10 years, my grandfather passed away, and he had the complete opposite experience. By then, my mom was a hospice social worker, and he had a beautiful end. She called us in to let us know that he had made the decision to forego treatments and to come off of his heart medication. And we all got a chance to say goodbye to him. And there was peace and closure. We got our last lessons learned from him. And it just was such a beautiful end that really taught me that endings matter, not just for the dying person, but for those that are left behind. And it became what I wanted to become, my life's work. I fortunately had a background doing political advocacy work and in public policy. And so when the position opened at Compassion and Choices, I was very well aligned for the position and had the opportunity to come work here.
Wow. Very cool story. Quite the story. Not cool. That's not the way to describe it, but just very unique and motivating and empowering that you decided to kind of make this your life's work and honor your family like that. That's really impressive. Thank you for sharing those stories with us. And so how did you kind of know about the organization prior to getting involved with them, or did you hear about it through like a hospice agency? You mentioned your mother was a hospice worker. And also, do you think your mother had influence on you kind of traveling down this path as well?
Yeah, my mom, I'll start with the mom first and then I'll go to the other. So my mom definitely had an impact on me. Talking about death was not the scary thing that it is in many other families, because she worked in hospice care towards the end of, like when I was in my teen years, she went into hospice care. And she would also share a lot of stories when she would come home at night about what the experience was like and how much suffering there was. So it was more normalized in our family to have conversations. And so that definitely drew me to the topic. I actually had no familiarity with Compassion and Choices before I applied for the position, which was both exciting for me because it told me that there was work that the organization could do to raise their profile and their visibility. And that is part of my background. So I was excited by that opportunity. I was at the time I had was working, I had about a decade of experience working in advocacy work and for political campaigns. And then I did about a decade in social marketing campaigns. And then I did another 6 or so years where I was doing work at a for-profit company running the public health and social marketing division for different government agencies, NIH, HHS, around different public health issues. And while I was there, I realized that I missed the advocacy work and that while I was making good money and theoretically at the peak of my career, I had just had an amazing year bringing new business into this company. I was missing what I loved about my job, which was feeling as if I was making a difference in the world. And so I did a hard look at, you know, where do I want to be in my life and how do I want to contribute? And went to my husband and said, I'm really sorry. I know that we chose the house we lived in and to send our kids to the school we went to and all of the things that require a salary that I was earning, but I don't have joy and satisfaction in my work and I'm spending too much time there. Will you support me? And fortunately, I have an amazing husband and he said, absolutely. And didn't throw it in my face because I was the one who wanted the new house, not him. And he just supported me. And so it took us about 2 years for me to kind of unravel the financial kind of intricacies of our lives to a point where I could move and work at a nonprofit. But as soon as I got there, I started to look around and I had a job. There was nothing wrong with it. It just wasn't giving me passion. So I was very careful. I only wanted to go to a job where it was an issue I felt passionate about. And I only wanted to work someplace where I felt like I was going to be in a leadership role where I could have a positive influence. And I just got fortunate. It was like all things lined up. And here I am now. It's been almost 7 years and I've never looked back. And the message I would give to anyone who is in a job that isn't bringing them joy and satisfaction is the time is now to move.
Wow. Okay. Now that's a cool story. That's where I'll use that description. Very cool and just impressive that you were willing to take that risk and kind of just strip yourself down and reevaluate what makes you happy. And it takes people like you to be in this role to make progress and advocacy. And that's just impressive to kind of almost do like a complete 180 with your life. And the fact that your family was so supportive, very, very good stuff. I wanted to go back a little bit. You mentioned your mom and her role as a hospice worker, and it's evident that you and your family seem very comfortable about the topic of death and likely, you know, aid in dying. As you have worked in this field, do you feel that working with other families and even just colleagues, do you feel that that is a similar trend, or do you think that it's more of a taboo subject for people and for families to kind of talk about death and just, I guess, what to expect?
Yeah, I think it really varies. So I would say my side of the family is more comfortable talking about the topic, but my husband's side of the family is not, and except for his father-in-law. And I actually have a pretty amazing story with his father-in-law, but he comes from the South. He's African-American, extremely religious. And there is much less comfort both with the topic of medical aid in dying as well as end of life in general. And I do think that culturally, you see very different experiences depending on your upbringing. And it's important that we don't make anybody wrong for their values or their priorities or their cultural beliefs. The option that we're trying to bring around medical aid in dying is definitely not the option for everybody. But it is an option that we know improves end-of-life care across the board, and it's important to a small segment of the population. And for those reasons, it's important that we have it is a legal option in all states.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you spoke to that beautifully. It's an opportunity to celebrate having that choice. And like you said, it's not for everyone, and that's okay. But I think for some people, it's certainly an opportunity. Now, tell us a little bit about your role within Compassionate Choices. It sounds like from working and talking with you and some of the people within the organization, it's quite a national kind of movement or organization. Can you tell us about how you guys operate across the U.S. and how your role or how you act in your role?
Sure. So I came to Compassion and Choices about seven years ago, and I started out in the role of Chief Program Officer, which is the number two position at the time, leading all of the programs across the country. And feel really fortunate because I got to work under Barbara Coombs Lee, who was in essence the founding CEO of the organization, and she had really been with it from the very beginning, building it up for that point about 20 years. And so I got the chance to kind of learn the issue under her tutelage. And they hired me because I had an extremely strong background in advocacy and managing large organizations. And they were really looking at the time, we were just starting to become a national organization and a national movement. And we had an infusion of cash. And they were trying to figure out, okay, we're in a handful of states. How do we take this national? And so they brought me in for my management experience, and it was an opportunity for me to really grow and learn the issue under the kind of preeminent expert at the time. And so it was really fortunate. I came in right away. There was an amazing group of talented staff that were in place. And I was able to help work with them to move from a much more regional focus to national. So it was right as Brittany Menard, I think you had Dan Diaz on one of your podcasts, is that right?
Correct, yes.
Right as Brittany Menard had come forward and shared her story, we had a campaign in California to authorize the option. And at that moment, there were only five states that were authorized. And you were seeing really, really slow momentum kind of taking place across the country. And Brittany was an opportunity like nothing the organization had ever seen, and kind of all things lined up. So we were able to take it national. We went from legislation in seven states to legislation in 26 states, like overnight. It was like all of a sudden, everybody wanted to introduce legislation. And we had been this fringe issue that nobody wanted to talk about. And now we were getting phone calls from lawmakers that were like, we want to, you know, do this. How do we do this? Help us. And so if you think about an organization, I mean, that's like huge change for an organization that's used to working in a couple of different places. So we really had to kind of model what I had worked in Emily's List before that and worked for as a consultant with a number of large national advocacy organizations. So we had to kind of mirror a model with a regional structure in place to address those issues. Be able to figure out how do you build tools so that we're not so focused on one state, but how do we build tools that every state can benefit from, but at the same time, recognizing that organizing is local. And so we do organizing local. So we kind of built out for the next couple of years our infrastructure and had to build out both. We had an infusion of cash, but it was a short-term infusion. So we had to build out both resources as well as the programmatic areas. And it was, I mean, it was an incredible opportunity, and I feel so privileged by the team that works at the organization. I have never worked with such smart, compassionate individuals, and it's also a testament to the volunteers that are out there and our storytellers. I know that you have recently joined to become one, so thank you for that. You know, Brittany kind of came out and shared her story, and she transformed the movement. But it has taken hundreds of other people to carry the torch, because it is only with the courage of a terminally ill individual that we are able to demonstrate to lawmakers why this matters. And without them, they don't really care about what I have to say. They don't care about what other policy experts have to say. It's individuals from their community whose voices help to communicate why this matters. And through all of that, through our generous donors, the incredibly courageous storytellers, a really tremendous staff of people, thousands and thousands of volunteers across the country, we have just made what I think is unprecedented progress. So you have, you know, since that point, California authorized a year later, it was a 5-year campaign. So it was supposed to be 5 years to get California authorized from that moment. And I remember in my interview, one of my staff who's still with us, our chief advocacy officer, Kevin Diaz, I said to me, you know, are you, you know, we want someone who's going to stay in this role for a long time. And I said, well, I'm not going anywhere as long as there's still work to be done. And he goes, what do you mean? And I was like, well, I mean, if we authorize every state and, you know, we finish the mission, then, you know, I don't need to be there. But until we kind of get the work done, I plan to be around. And so he said to me, oh, you know, right now you're coming in and there's 5 states authorized. If we get California authorized within 10 years, that will be an accomplishment. And then literally, a year later, California authorized.
Wow.
And I think the smartest thing that we did as an organization, and it's funny because I was so like new in my role at the time, I didn't think of it as particularly courageous. But now that I sort of look back on it, I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe we did that. But after California authorized, we wanted to be sure we replicated the kind of success that you saw in the marriage equality movement. And we knew we had public support, but how do you actually make there be another quick win so we can kind of start the momentum going? And we knew we needed to do a ballot initiative somewhere because it's easier to control things in a ballot initiative because the citizens are voting as opposed to lawmakers where you've got so many other things influencing things. So we went to the board of directors and we said, we want to do a ballot initiative in Colorado. We only have, it was like, God, I don't know, it was like 8 months before the election. So it's a short period of time. We only have like 8 or 9 months. We would fund it, set up a separate infrastructure that would run independently, and we would need you to put $5 million into this. And they approved it. And like, I look back on it, I was like, I can't believe we went to the board and asked for $5 million and they did it. And then we won, like, you know, overwhelming support. And it was incredible because it did create that, you know, domino effect. It started exactly what we wanted to happen, started to happen after that. It went Colorado, then we did DC, Hawaii, New Jersey, Maine, we just did New Hampshire. So now we're up to 10 states and Washington, DC. And each session, we tend to authorize one more state, and that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to would be great to get them all at the same time. Like, I'm not suggesting we wouldn't want more progress, but we're trying to be realistic. We're in times where few legislation is actually passing. And if we can just keep a state accession moving forward, the dominoes will keep falling.
Wow. That is impressive. What a fabulous collaborative organization, and for a good cause. I like how you speak about your colleagues and the people involved as well, the volunteers from top to bottom. I would think that with such kind of a heavier topic in a sense, that you would have to really, you know, be all in to join and participate in something like this. So I can imagine you really come across some wonderful individuals. So again, people like you and your organization who really help people who are like me, you know, have these options and choices. So I think just having that choice, it comes down to having the choice, and that's what's really important for someone like myself. So thank you again. I wanted to ask a little bit about the political piece. You mentioned you live kind of near Washington, D.C. Is that by design? Is that because you are so involved in like legislation type stuff that you got to shoot over there frequently? Tell us a little bit about what it's like getting involved in more of that political realm.
Sure. So most of the medical aid and dying laws take place at the state level because the practice of medicine is governed at the state level. So if you're talking specifically about the work around medical aid and dying, I'm just as likely to fly into a state capital across anywhere in the country as I am into Washington, D.C. But when they were hiring my position as the chief program officer, they did want somebody who was based in the D.C. area at the time. And that was because the organization doesn't just work on medical aid and dying. We also work across ensuring that people have the full spectrum of end-of-life options. And one of the important things we do is work at the federal level to ensure that we are helping to address the inequities in end-of-life care that exist, helping to ensure that people have access to hospice care and palliative care, that we improve, you know, training for physicians. And that's all work that can take place at the federal level. And we were just starting to build that portfolio of work out at the time. And so they were looking for somebody in DC. I also think it's quite common for national organizations to have a DC presence. That's just sort of where things are. So I wouldn't say I spend, especially in my current job as CEO, I probably spend as much time out in the community as I do in DC. But initially when they hired me, they did want a greater presence within DC.
Okay.
It's very astute. The other thing that I will just add back to the comments that you were saying before about how I must meet some really tremendous people. And I just want to underscore that. I really do. And I remember when I first was talking to my husband about, you know, do I want to take this job and what would be it be like? The only concern that I had was how hard it would be. Like, did I think it would be hard or like depressing to work in the space of end-of-life care where you're constantly talking about death? And there's no question, like we lose storytellers all the time that we've built close relationships with, and it is hard. And, you know, losing people constantly is hard. So I don't want to minimize that there is a difficult aspect to it. But what I have found more than anything is that I am inspired every day by the way that our supporters and storytellers choose to live their lives. And it makes me a better person. It makes me recognize that I shouldn't get upset about the little things, because if I had knew I had a limited amount of time left, I'm not going to fight with my mom over some stupid thing, or I'm not going to get upset with my daughter over something. Like, I'm going to focus on making sure that every day of my life is spent making meaning and contributing to the people around me. And so I try to carry their spirit with me, your spirit with me. I mean, you're a great example of that, and say, and live my life that way every day. And so I feel like it's been a gift, because I feel like I have so much more joy in my life than I otherwise would have if not for the gift of our storytellers. So thank you to you, because the fact that you are facing a terminal diagnosis and you chose to start a podcast and to use your voice, I mean, that's tremendous. And you have limited time and you're still giving back to people and to society. And that for me is hugely inspiring. So thank you for what you do.
Of course, Ren, that's really sweet of you to say. And just very, I thought, very powerful, your words. And yeah, those were some of the pieces, or one of the questions I had was just if there are any real specific people that stand out to you as you moved along. It sounds like you built some really wonderful relationships along the way. If there's any, whether it's a colleague or a storyteller, and if you don't mind too, can you just kind of define and tell us about the storyteller program and kind of what that's about for
sure.
The listeners?
So our storyteller program is about lifting the voices of people who either themselves have a terminal diagnosis or who have experienced somebody at the end of life, where that story could have a profound and positive impact in end of life care and helping us to change policies, helping us to change the medical system, and helping us to raise awareness. So we started out with much of our storyteller kind of mirroring Brittany Menard with people who wanted the option of medical aid in dying and were terminally ill themselves, being willing to share their story. And then we had family members who were willing to share the stories around medical aid in dying, who of people who didn't have the option, who unfortunately needlessly suffered. As we've been working to improve medical aid in dying laws in other states, we have now storytellers who are speaking to some of the barriers that exist in different states and some of the improvements we're trying to make through the legislation. But as importantly, what we found in reaching, you asked the question earlier about different communities and whether different people are in different places, we found that for communities and for individuals who are not yet comfortable talking about the end of life, that we need to do a step back and we need to have storytellers who are helping to explain why the issue matters. Why do we care? More people talking about advanced care planning and the impact advanced care planning or a lack of advanced care planning could have on the end. People who come from different cultures and different communities. So there really is lots of opportunities and storytellers are tapped into depending on their interests in many different ways. So some people are doing direct work with lawmakers. We might help them to draft a letter to the editor or an op-ed. Others like you have taken on to doing podcasts. And some it's just posted up on our website. So there's a kind of wide degree. The amount that a story is covered is often dependent upon what it is. The media really likes to cover, which is hard. They want to cover the person who is terminally ill, who wants the option. So those are the stories that tend to get picked up the most, especially in a state where we have legislation that's advancing. So we're trying to do more work. Like, we really want to just generate positive stories also about people who've had positive end of life experiences, but it tends to be difficult to cover those. We also do some videos, some promotional materials where we'll use different stories in those as well.
Excellent. That's a very, just powerful piece of the organization. And I get the feel and the vibe that one of the, it seems like, strengths of your organization is displaying empathy and kind of presenting this information, I think, in a gentle way to people. And also just kind of the reminder that these are choices. They aren't something that everybody has to follow through with. So I really appreciate that you guys have such an open and understanding mindset as you work on the legislation piece. And a little bit with that, as you move forward and the organization moves forward, how would you envision some of this unraveling with legislation in different states and even federally?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And I do realize you asked me and I didn't answer whether there were any particular storytellers that I carry. So first of all, I have met hundreds of incredible people and they all touch me and inspire me in some ways. Of course, Brittany's story, like that's just one that carries everybody. One of the early storytellers for me that's really been foundational is a woman named Heather, who she did work with us in Delaware and had done lobbying for lots of different issues herself, like professionally. And then unfortunately was very young and got this option. And she sent me an email just as I was becoming the CEO of Compassion and Choices that basically said, "Unfortunately, my time has come and we haven't made this option legal yet in Delaware. And I am so excited that you've now become the CEO and promise me that you will continue this fight on my behalf." And so I have carried a piece of Heather with me throughout my entire time as CEO, knowing that I have made her that promise. It's people like her and, in all of the states, there's always been at least one storyteller who's kind of been the face of the movement. So Mary Klein in Washington, D.C. and John Radcliffe in Hawaii. I mean, just they are such compassionate people. And most of them have no desire to be a public figure. Like, I remember conversations with Mary Klein, who was our D.C. storyteller, and she said, "I don't want to be the public face of this. I just want the option available." And she kept trying to not be the public face, but we couldn't break through with legislation. And then after we authorized and we moved to implementation, we couldn't get doctors to participate. And finally, she was like, "If the only way that we can get a doctor to participate is for me to be the public face, I'll do it." And we promoted it right away, and we had like 8 doctors come out of the woodwork right away, and she got the prescription and it opened it up for everybody. But it both demonstrates the courage of these people, the power of the storyteller, the humility, like, and so they all touch me in some way. But those are just a couple of that have really left a mark on me. Hey, Andrew, I seem to have lost your voice.
There you go. Little tech issue. Thank you for sharing the story and doubling back to that question as well. A lot to digest there and think about different stories, the different paths these people travel and how they're still willing to not only take on their role of having a terminal diagnosis, but the extra roles of advocating and fighting for, that option to the End of Life Option Act and having that choice. I guess kind of back to that, the legislative piece, what do you envision as we move forward and as you and your organization continue to advocate for this option?
Sure. So that's a great question. So I think there, our hope and our intention is to continue seeing more states authorize the option of medical aid in dying. That's something that is obviously so important. We've been able to authorize about a state a year since 2015. And I think you'll continue to see that take place. And we're going to continue to work to make sure that takes place. And if somehow we get stalled, we might pull another rabbit out of the hat. But, you know, we've got to kind of keep that momentum going. At the same time, we have a tremendous amount of evidence and data that shows opportunities to improve the law. And it's not around the eligibility criteria, but around ensuring that we're achieving the original intention of the law and making sure that people are able to access the law who are eligible. We made some very good improvements to the law in the recent California reauthorization, as well as when New Mexico passed the law for the first time back in March of 2021. So I do imagine that you're going to see more states making some of those similar improvements to the law. I actually just got off of a hearing right before this with Vermont, where they are considering some improvements to their bill. We'll have improvements in both Hawaii and Washington State going forward. And our hope is that in the states that don't yet have legislation, they'll do what New Mexico did and they'll just pass a better bill. But I will say that unfortunately, lawmakers tend to be very conservative, and their frame of reference is that more regulation is better because it's more protections. And they're not really understanding that those regulations are actually roadblocks for a dying person. And the length of, you know, when someone has 6 months or less to live, it sounds like that's a lot of time, but most people don't get that prognosis until they really only have a few months left. And then finding 2 doctors and going through this tedious process both takes away precious time from the person and also is not easy. Like you have to, it's optional for doctors to participate and for health systems to participate. And so there are natural inherent roadblocks in the legislation without having things like 15-day waiting periods, which most of the legislation currently includes. So I think you'll see that taking place. But as importantly, medical aid in dying is an option for people who already have access to good care and the end of life, and who therefore then can choose autonomy. The other thing that I think is really important is in this movement is that we address the disparities that exist in other end of life care options like hospice and palliative care and pain management. And so that's some of the other work that the organization is doing. And I think it's really important in this environment that we remember that it is as important that we bring all end of life care options to everybody and we address those disparities as it is that we bring this important option of autonomy across the country. So we're balancing those 2 options and working to see kind of both of them move forward.
Yeah, that's impressive, or a lot on your plate there for sure. But seems like you guys are covering every aspect of this topic, which is again very impressive. Do you think that moving forward, or I'm sorry, let me back up. It almost seems like there are like seasons of when this topic becomes more relevant, and maybe it's by different regions or different areas. You're mentioning how it seems like there's that trend of every year there's a different state that passes the, you know, some sort of legislation. So can you speak a little bit more to, I guess, to that trend and getting others involved, storytellers involved and such? You mentioned that it seems like there just needs to be that little extra push, I guess, at times to get the legislation maybe moving in a better direction. And with that, I wondered if you could speak to just some of the barriers. What if you notice like a trend of the most difficult barriers to getting something like this passed? Maybe sure. It's religious beliefs, whatever it might be. So yeah, anything you got in that department?
Sure. So these are such good questions. So legislative sessions are vary by state, but they typically are kind of the busiest season in most states, kind of January to March, April or May.
Uh-oh. Crazy. Uh-oh.
Massachusetts are year-round legislative sessions, so those go all year round. But most of the states, it's kind of January to March, April, May, somewhere in there is when legislative session takes place. In terms of the topic of death, you know, obviously people die all the time. The holidays are often a time where that hits hard for people that have lost a loved one. So you might see that topic coming up around the holidays. We often talk about Thanksgiving being a time when people can come together, be thankful for their loved ones, and do end-of-life planning. So sometimes you might hear about more about end-of-life planning around Thanksgiving, but I do think it's sort of a year-round thing. In terms of the moving legislation forward, as is the case with every piece of legislation, it takes a kind of confluence of factors to pass a piece of legislation. It is easier for lawmakers to do nothing than it is to pass legislation. So their default mode is let me do nothing. And they get thousands and thousands of pieces of legislation that are considered. And depending on the state, it's, you know, 1 or 2% that might actually pass. And if you look at the really, really polarized times that we're in right now, you're seeing even fewer pieces of legislation pass. And then you're seeing lawmakers only want to pass legislation that has to do with COVID because we're in a period of crisis. So all of those factors are kind of playing, and it's actually a miracle that we got New Mexico passed kind of in the midst of COVID when you sort of think about all the factors that were taking place then. Very little was taken, California as well. But I think, well, people who have COVID are not able to access the option of medical aid in dying. What COVID did do for this issue was demonstrate that medicine cannot relieve all suffering, and that that the importance of having that option and having that available to somebody who's dying is real and important. And so I think in that way, it did help to elevate the issue and keep us relevant at a time where it's really hard to get legislation passed. In terms of what we're up against in most states, and I would say in all states, really, the Catholic Church and evangelical Christians are the biggest opponents to medical aid in dying legislation across the country. And they're opposing it based on their own ethical and moral values, where they see it as being equivalent to suicide. The reality is that medical aid in dying and suicide are entirely different. The National Association of Suicide or American Association of Suicidology has created the distinction. All of the laws create the distinction. The American College of Legal Medicine creates the distinction. Somebody who wants the option of medical aid in dying desperately wants to live. They have a disease taking their life, and they're simply choosing the manner in which they will die, as opposed to someone who's suicidal, where there are treatment options that could be applied and given, provided to them, that could potentially relieve their suffering and allow them to live a long life. That option's not available to somebody who's choosing medical aid and dying. And so, but the Catholic Church is morally opposed to it. They are very powerful. They have an extremely, extremely strong lobby, and they're well-funded. And so we've got sort of, you know, while we're the largest national organization and, you know, we've got a reasonable size budget, if you compare us to the Catholic Church or to all the many entities of political advocacy organizations that are on the side of the Catholic Church, we're like a little peanut in comparison. And so what we have on our side is powerful grassroots momentum and courageous storytellers. And we're on the right side of the issue, and those things are balancing it out for us, but it doesn't make it without a significant obstacle. We also see obstacles from, in some places, not all, but in some places, some in the disability community are concerned about abuse or coercion, and it's understandable. They have had systemic inequities against them with people devaluing their lives. What the data shows is that with the option of medical aid in dying, it's far more transparent than other end-of-life care options. So it actually makes it much less a chance of abuse or coercion. People are requesting the option themselves multiple times. It's all out in the public. Whereas with other end-of-life care options, it's a third party, like a doctor, choosing palliative sedation for the patient. There's far greater risk of abuse or coercion. That said, there's concern among some within the disability community, not people with disabilities. And I would say that's the same with the Catholic Church. It's not when you survey Catholics themselves, it's the leadership and the hierarchy within those industries. So those are kind of the two biggest opponents to the legislation. And then I would say there used to be a third within medicine, but that's really neutralized in the last 6 or 7 years. And now you really see the majority of doctors who believe the option should be available to their patients. You're seeing a growing number of medical societies dropping their opposition and adopting either neutral or supportive policies, recognizing that patients want a voice and a choice in the kind of care they receive. What we still need to work on and do is getting more doctors comfortable with supporting their patients with this option. So you have large numbers who support the option and want it to be available, and smaller numbers who are willing to support their patients in accessing those options. And that's, I think, just part of that sort of adoption of this as a standard medical practice. We're making good progress, and, you know, considerably more work needs to be done. But they don't tend to be as much of a problem within legislatures as they used to be. That's more of work to be done within the implementation of the laws.
Okay, very good. Very well spoken, you know, to that question. Great answer. Kind of pivoting in a sense, this is more of like a scenario. I was reading a newspaper article. I think it was in the LA Times or the San Diego. It was probably the LA Times, but it was about a woman, I believe, with ALS who qualifies for the End of Life Option Act. And she was in a particular situation because she was very of sound mind. Physically, her body was deteriorating. She wasn't emotionally in a place where she was ready to use the medication, but she's also kind of balancing that line where she might physically not be able to use the medication. And obviously that's a very difficult situation. I wonder if you could talk about that scenario or do you ever anticipate like any sort of legislative safeguard or something for an individual who might be in that situation where they are in sound mind, but maybe physically, maybe like they're paraplegic or something? Because I believe the bill here in California is that the individual actually takes and administers the medication themselves.
Yeah, so I think there's a little bit of confusion around what the law actually calls for. The law does allow a person to have assistance in taking the medication. And when you look across the data, people with ALS are like second to cancer in terms of who uses the option. So all that the legislation requires is that the person is taking an affirmative action towards being able to, that it's their choice in the end. So you do have the option of rectal catheters. You do have the option. There could even be the option of assisted technology that, you know, could be used if, you know, someone who is disabled is using an eye gazer. But there's a safeguard that's in place that I think is an important safeguard, is knowing that it is the person who's taking that step in that act versus a third party performing that act on behalf of somebody else. And that's a safeguard that I think is important to the disability community themselves. We've heard from members of the disability community that that is the option that they want. And it's also kind of what has been necessary here in the United States to be able to get the laws passed.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying that and sharing that answer. How can people, how can like an average individual become involved with something like Compassionate Choices? You mentioned you have a lot of volunteers who are involved. How can people get involved? Someone who's listening to this podcast, they decide, hey, like this seems like a cool group to help join and advocate for. What can I do to get involved? What would you suggest to them?
Thanks, Andrew. It's a great question, and I'm glad you asked it because we definitely want more people getting involved. The easiest way to get involved is to go to www.compassionandchoices.org. You'll see a section on our website that says Take Action, and the person can then sign up to be a volunteer. And we'll then reach back out to them and get them connected depending on what their interests are. There are lots of ways to volunteer. You can volunteer in your local community, giving public presentations. You can volunteer doing legislative advocacy work. We obviously have our storyteller volunteers that we've talked about. We've got medical doctors that volunteer, nurses, all kinds of clinicians. We have leadership councils representing different communities. So there's lots of different ways to get involved. We are definitely a people-driven movement. None of this of our progress would be possible if it was not for individual people. And so I encourage you. And the other thing that's important is people can get involved in small or large ways. So we have some volunteers who've literally led major efforts to get like health systems to adopt supportive policies in their communities, or to get a medical society to adopt a policy, or who are intricate to the legislative efforts. And then we have other people who are just on our listserv, and they might take an action and call their member of Congress or their state legislature, or, you know, write a letter to the editor. It might be like an occasional thing for them. But all of, you know, however someone decides to engage and get involved with it, the accumulation of all of those acts are what gives us the power that we have. And then, of course, people can also contribute because we are 100% kind of run on donated funds. And that's another easy way that someone can make a difference in this issue.
All right, cool. So it seems like really there's all sorts of different levels of involvement. So for people who are listening, if that's something you're interested in, you know what to do now. That's awesome, Kim. Thank you for sharing that. And I got just a couple more questions here. The first one is just really to open it up to you. If there's anything else you'd like to share about the topic or anything you really think we should know or the listeners should know, we'd love to hear it. And then I also like to send it over to Hasban. He usually has some real good questions towards the end of these discussions as we, you know, kind of work together. But yeah, is there any, back to that first one real quick, anything else you would like to share with the listeners?
So, I mean, I think you've actually been really thorough in terms of the questions that you've asked. So I'm like having a hard time thinking of something that you haven't already asked, but
cool. No, that's okay.
I guess I would just sort of reinforce the importance of individual volunteer efforts in realizing change within this issue. And I guess the one thing that I would add that you haven't talked about as much that I think is important for people is we have many, many people that are involved in our movement who have not taken the appropriate steps to ensure that they have safeguarded their future around their end of life options. And on our website, we have some great advanced care planning tools, and we also link to state forms. We have a dementia values and priorities tool. And one of the heartbreaking things that happens, and you asked if there's ever kind of storytellers that have left with me. And one of the storytellers that has left an impression on me was someone who was super, super active in the movement. And I've met with a million times, and I just made the assumption that they had filled out everything and that they were ready, and they had conversations with their loved ones about what they wanted at the end of life. And unfortunately they hadn't, and that end of life experience did not go well. And, you know, I personally felt like I had failed them, because all of our conversations had been about system change, and here they hadn't done the basic things to take care of their own end of life experience. So I encourage people that are listening to this podcast to not forget yourself. Figure out what your priorities are, what's important to you, and most important, identify a healthcare proxy, the person that you trust to speak on your behalf. Because if you're ever in a situation where you can't speak for yourself, you want to know that that person understands what your priorities and values are. So I guess that would be my final closing thoughts.
Beautiful. That's awesome. And with that too, yeah, you people heard it here first, and just from Kim exactly. And I think in life, you never expect these things to happen to you. And sometimes they do. And, you know, these events might occur, and it seems like we have a exit plan ready for almost everything in life, except the ultimate exit. So I think certainly what you just said is so, so valuable and important. Thank you for sharing that. And Hasban, I know you've got a couple gems lined up, so I'll send it over your way.
I really enjoyed like hearing you speak, Kim. I felt like you both had a very thorough conversation. I thought I knew a lot about the subject, and just learned so much more. Even that last part about they don't have to do it themselves; they just have to affirm that they want to do it. But one thing I've been thinking about is, like, you know, we talk about the fact that everybody has to go through death at some point, and everyone's going to face this. So I would think this issue would be like bigger and louder, but it seems like such a niche issue, and it doesn't make sense to me. Then I started thinking about it. I was like, well, maybe it's because, you know, a lot of people die. That's true. And everyone has to deal with it. Obviously everybody dies, but what percent of deaths or something like where end of life option would even be a consideration? You know, maybe a lot more people died because of like immediate trauma, like a car accident or something, you know, and maybe that's why this issue is not a big deal to a lot of people, or just not in their consciousness. So again, what percent of deaths do you think, or what percent of people, I don't know if you have any data on it.
Yeah. Let me go back, Hasban, to what you said, because I want to be sure what I said was accurate. A person does have to take an affirmative action and step themselves, but somebody can assist them with like holding the cup. So they may have to sip out of a straw, as an example, might be their affirmative action. Or I don't know anyone who's done it yet, but you could see using assisted technology like an eye gazer. So it's some type of an affirmative action. Okay. They do have to be doing it themselves. So I didn't want to leave a misperception if I had.
No, for sure. For sure. Thank you for clarifying.
In terms of how many people, I'm not sure that I know the answer to the vast majority of people are dying, you know, from some type of a terminal disease. So I do think that this as a topic is a topic that's relevant to a lot of people. We know that only a small number of people choose the option of medical aid in dying. So in the states where the option exists, it's fewer than 1% of people are choosing the option, but large percentages of people want the option available and get a peace of mind simply knowing that exists and that it's available to them. I think that the reason that this topic doesn't elevate as high is because there's this like false kind of belief, like if I don't talk about it, it's not going to happen to me. And that you delay conversations and like maybe it won't happen in some way, and it's not a, you know, like people are here and they want to live, and of course we want to live, I want to live, I think it's just, you know, if you think about procrastination in general, people tend to procrastinate things that they don't like. It doesn't feel like this is going to happen to you anytime soon. And then it's a little uncomfortable talking about it. And then you try to raise it with someone and they don't want to talk about it. And so it's just kind of gets into the pattern of doing nothing. But we did see during COVID, when this issue was front and center and people were seeing loved ones die catastrophic deaths by themselves, we got an increased number of calls happening to our hotline with people saying, what kind of steps do I need to take? And so I think when people are in the face of it, they are more likely to take steps. And I also think we have some different generational differences. And this younger generation that's coming up, they are really, really different. My daughter, and it's not just because she's my daughter, because I see it in all of her friends too. And you read about it when you read about the literature. They are just far more comfortable, like saying it as it is and talking about it. I think they're also experiencing more death. Like a lot of us, Atul Gawande talks about this in his book, societies that experience a lot of death regularly, it's our talk about it more, but we only experience death once every 40 or 50 years. It's become, because we live life so long and we've become so good, that most people aren't experiencing it, fortunately. So I think that both you're going to see this change as you have baby boomers retiring, they're watching their aging parents, they're contemplating their own mortality. You've got this younger generation who's really pushing for kind of a different kind of experience, not just at the end of life, but just across the board. So I think we're sort of at the brink of this being a really different topic in 5 or 10 years.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. Yeah, and you're right. One thing Andrew and I have spoken about is that the catalyst for this could be at any time. Like even we're putting stuff out, like you could see this topic blowing up at any point. And I had just one more question. Just want to clarify something. So Compassionate and Choices Action Net, like a network, are you guys associated with deathwithdignity.org? And who are the major players besides you guys in this whole organization? Because it seems like it's a small world.
Yeah. So Compassion and Choices is the leading national organization. We're at about $20 million a year now. Compassion and Choices Action Network is our 501c4 organization. We're allowed to do a limited amount of lobbying work through Compassion and Choices. We are through the Compassion and Choices Action Network, we can do an unlimited amount of lobbying and we can also influence elections. So they are two separate organizations. I happen to be the CEO of both, but they are operated separately. We have to file, you know, separate 990s, all of that kind of stuff to keep it all legal. Another one of the major national players in the movement is the Death with Dignity National Center. They are a separate organization. I think they're about a 10th or 20th of our size. They only focus, and I always hate speaking about another organization because I don't want to misstate, so I'd encourage people to go to their website, but I think they primarily focus on Oregon-style medical aid and dying laws, whereas we both do an advanced medical aid and dying laws, but we're also focused on disparities in care and end-of-life planning in a much broader scope, and we do both authorization and implementation of the laws. And they'll select like a handful of states. So we partner with them in some states. We're working together in Massachusetts right now. And we'll partner with them in some states as well. But they're a separate organization, but we do try to work with them collaboratively.
Cool. Yeah. I think you two seem to be the major organizations that show up when I have like looked at the topic. Yeah. But that's all I had. Again, just thank you for your time.
Yeah.
And one last question. What should we expect for 2022? Is there a certain state that you think is going to make that next push to pass some kind of legislation?
Yeah, so I think we're expecting legislation in about 15 states this year. I always wish I had a crystal ball and I could say how things will shake up, but I can tell you some of the states to kind of pay attention to and encourage people to sign up on our listserv, because we do give regular updates on our listserv for people that are on it. So Massachusetts and New York are two states that have been active and busy for quite a while that we will advance legislation in again, and we'll hopefully make progress. The same is true for Connecticut and Delaware. Both of them are very active. We're seeing much more work taking place within Minnesota. So that's another state to kind of keep an eye on in terms of authorization. Virginia, North Carolina will likely have legislation that's a little bit farther behind. And Nevada has gotten close the past couple of years. They don't have, they have a budget session this year, so there won't be active legislation, but they're one that will have legislation like in the future. And then we'll also see some states advancing legislation to improve their bills. Vermont, who I mentioned earlier, had a hearing today. Washington State will advance legislation to improve their bill, as will Hawaii. I'm sure that I've forgotten someplace, somebody on that list, but I think that's kind of a reasonable starting point of what legislation is active this session.
Yeah, that's exciting. It sounds like there's some good work being done. Excellent.
And we do have state pages on our website. So for anyone who's listening who wants to know what's happening in their state, you can go to Take Action and find your state and get state updates and sign up for state updates there. And, you know, that's, you know, sort of the easiest way for someone to keep up to state on their own state, up to date on their own state.
Excellent. Excellent. Fabulous information. Well, this is wonderful, Kim. That's, you know, that's kind of all I got in terms of questions. Again, thank you so much for your time, your advocacy, the work that your organization does, truly impressive. And it certainly helps people in my position and thousands of others. And yeah, it's this conversation itself. I'm going to need some time to really reflect on it. There was a lot of wonderful information, and I just really appreciate all the work that you people do. So thank you.
Well, thank you for having me, Andrew. It's really a delight. And I'm, as I said before, grateful for you having me on the podcast, but also for your willingness to serve as a storyteller. You know, it does not go unnoticed that your time is limited and you could choose to spend it in any way you want, and that you're choosing to spend it contributing to making society better. So thank you for that.
Thanks, Kim. That's very kind of you. I hope you have a wonderful day. We'll be sending good vibes your way as you guys continue your fight to advocate. And I hope that we get to cross paths again sometime in the future.
It sounds great. Thanks, Andrew.
Bye-bye. All right. Take care, Kim.
Bye, Kim.